May it please the court. I'm Jamie Matuska. I'm here on behalf of appellants who were plaintiffs in the underlying litigation. I don't want to go into a lengthy recitation of the facts. I presume the court has read the briefing, but I do want to draw to the court's attention to the procedural history of the case, because I'm not sure that it's entirely clear from the record or from the briefing how this case came to be here. The issues that are raised in the summary judgment that was ultimately granted were raised in a prior summary judgment motion and denied by the trial court. Objections were also filed to the summary judgment evidence, and those were overruled by the trial court. The case then proceeded to trial.
Were the exhibits and the objections the same in the first denial of a motion for summary judgment as what was filed in the second motion for summary judgment?
Largely, but not entirely.
Was it judged the same?
No, Your Honor. The case proceeded to trial in front of a different rotating judge than the one that granted the than the one that denied the original motion for summary judgment.
Were both no evidence motions for summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. They were both no evidence motions for summary judgment. And just to clarify on the record, there were multiple motions for summary judgment filed pre-trial. One of them was on an affirmative defense. There was also the no evidence motion on these grounds. This case proceeded to trial in front of a different judge. After 4 days of testimony, that judge entered a mistrial. That same day, defense counsel went back to the office and filed what it styled its August 18th, 2017, no evidence motion for summary judgment, in which it re-urged the point that there was no evidence on medical causation. So you will see in the record some prior summary judgments that are irrelevant to what was ultimately granted. The summary judgment in this case should be reversed. There's a lot in the briefing, but what I think is at the heart of the case is there's two reasons the summary judgment, primary reasons the summary judgment should be reversed. One, the affidavit of Dr. Sybil Woon, who is the treating physician, was admissible and should not have been excluded. That affidavit raises more than a scintilla of evidence of medical causation.
Those are order number one and two of orders, defendant's objections to plaintiff's summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. There are also exhibits, I believe, 32 and 33. Some form objections were cured, so you'll see those same affidavits in two places in the record. The second is the affidavit of the retained expert, Matthew Waxman. That affidavit is admissible. It should not have been stricken and constitutes more than a scintilla of evidence of medical causation. I don't want to spend too much time talking about the expert's qualifications because I think it is adequately fleshed out in the briefing, if the court and in the record. If the court looks at the record, it will see that both experts are exceedingly qualified to render the opinions they've rendered. I'll just note for the court that Dr. Sybil Woon is a board-certified neuro-ophthalmologist that has practiced for 25 years. She has extensive experience in evaluating and treating and diagnosing bilateral optic neuritis, which is what Mr. Garcia was diagnosed with in this case.
But what type of background does she have in malaria and other diseases?
Your Honor, she does not have specific experience with malaria, apart from a general knowledge that there are certain tropical diseases, such as malaria, that can affect eye structure and that have an effect on or can cause optic neuritis. She testified at length at trial and references in her affidavit some literature. There's a reference to a Holt and Walsh literature that she testified to.
I want to talk about that literature both as to Waxman, Dr. Waxman and Dr. Woon, because the first objection that the trial judge grants is that they relied on undisclosed data and literature. It sounds from the reading of the record that there was an article that was, the article in question is one between her depo and the time of trial. Then the motion for summary judgment is then heard thereafter. What is the procedural stance of if there is something that wasn't disclosed at trial? We know that that doesn't come in, but now we're 5 months arguing a summary judgment, can or cannot an expert then in the interim relied on a report or an article that was not provided to him at that time or disclosed at any time?
Well, Your Honor, absolutely, I think they can. One thing that I think is really important to note in this case, again, goes back to the procedural history. At the time this motion for summary judgment was filed, the court never issued a new scheduling order. So the parties left the trial, and the court says, I'm going to issue a new scheduling order, and that was never done. So absolutely, you know, discovery rules in general apply to evidence that comes into a summary judgment proceeding, but the unique procedural history of this case makes it so as a good cause for not having supplemented would be there's no trial date, there's no new scheduling order. They're also allowed to refine their opinions and to elaborate, if you will, on their opinions and their analysis, which they did in this case and which they felt required to do because they knew what objections were coming. This was not a no evidence summary judgment. These were Daubert Robinson issues that were just, you know, pigeonholed into a summary judgment. So that's why these extensive affidavits were filed post-trial. Now, I'd submit to the court that everything Dr. Waxman put in her affidavit is in her trial testimony. I mean, she testified at length ad nauseum about her opinions and what she reviewed. And what I also want to note for the court is that she was not a retained expert. The rules did not require her to disclose every single thing she reviewed. She's a treating physician, and she had treated Dr. Garcia since 2013 and had said multiple times and throughout the entirety of this case that this was a unique case for her with the optic neuritis and how it presented itself. And she was studying and researching and reading in order to be able to treat her patient. The discovery rules, I think, Your Honor, if you take a close look at the rules, you will see they were not violated with regard to the literature. You know, they didn't violate those
rules. Even if you're not, if there's no discovery order in place, the rules do require you to supplement discovery, supplement depositions when, if at time, you become aware of it. And it's my understanding that this was never supplemented in any time by you in regards to saying, oh, here, by the way, here's another article or more testing or anything. It was just in the affidavit but was not in any of your discoveries. So shouldn't you have been mandated to also do it in your discovery so it could be used as proper summary judgment evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that it was all on the record at trial. I mean, the rules don't require you to supplement in writing if you've already, if the information's been made available on the record. Dr. Woon absolutely 100% testified about the literature, and even with regard to Dr. Waxman, because interestingly, the complaint there does not really appear to be about literature. He testified, but if it is, he testified at trial about his knowledge of literature. He's published himself on malaria. So those weren't necessarily things he reviewed just in this case, but it's in the record. So I don't think there was a duty to supplement it because it was on the trial record. He also testified. The big complaint here with regard to Dr. Waxman is that his original report referenced the review of one deposition. His post-trial affidavit referenced the review of multiple depositions in this case. Now, most of them were lay witnesses whose testimony has absolutely nothing to do with the medical causation issue. But he did reference Dr. Woon's deposition and Dr. Lee, the defendant's expert's deposition in his post-trial affidavit. But the thing is, he testified at trial. He testified he reviewed the transcripts and the deposition in the case. And the other thing is, his opinions never changed. I mean, there's nothing to show that anything in any materials that he reviewed changed any of his opinions. I mean, you absolutely have a duty to, you know, update your expert report in regards to the opinions of your retained expert. But everybody in this case knew what materials had been reviewed, and when we're talking about a deposition that he may have referenced an additional deposition, that is not proper grounds for excluding the witness, the expert witness, entirely. It's not authorized under Rule 193.6. At most, was there evidence documents, materials that they relied on that was not disclosed, if there was a violation of the rules, and I'd submit to the court there wasn't, at most, that information doesn't come in. You don't exclude an expert entirely, and if you read the brief, you will read over and over and over again, new opinions, new opinions, new opinions. But defendant has not articulated once what new opinions, because there weren't any. There weren't any new opinions to strike. And although they reference that over and over, the trial court didn't rule on that.
I want to go back to Justice Perks' question, though, regarding Dr. Woon.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is noted that she is qualified. The question becomes, is she qualified to give a causation expert testimony as to malaria? And there's a, whether it's a, I think it was called a differential diagnosis or just a diagnosis. So what expertise does Dr. Woon bring to the table that she's qualified to connect the dots? Because this is a medical causation, as in all toxic tort cases that we're familiar with, and it's the causation of whether these cases sink or die on, really. So what does Dr. Woon have that could give her the qualifications to give the causation issue, which is a second objection?
Well,
she may be qualified about other things, but what is she qualified to do the malaria causation issue?
Right. Well, I think she's qualified in her training, and she did testify at length about being knowledgeable about the literature that talks about how malaria affects ash structure. Now, she admits that she is not an expert in treating malaria, but she is very qualified to go through the differential diagnosis and the process of eliminating all of the other possible causes of optic neuritis, which she is extensively knowledgeable about. And before I elaborate on that, Your Honor, I want to point out to the court, at the trial court limited Dr. Woon's testimony. At the trial, the court did not exclude her as a witness. The trial court concluded that Dr. Woon would not be permitted to opine that Garcia contracted malaria. However, the trial court expressly stated on the record that she certainly would be allowed to opine that a person suffering from optic neuritis, excuse me, Your Honor, let me just read the quote here from the record. Dr. Woon will not be permitted to opine Garcia contracted malaria. However, she will be allowed to opine malaria in a person suffering from malaria can cause optic neuritis. That is essentially undisputed.
Okay, so was the objection to her affidavit broader than that, than what he limited her testimony to at time of trial?
I don't think it was, Your Honor, and to the extent that it was, it's insufficient. I mean, she's qualified to make the etiology determination, and if I have time, I'd like, there's a few things about it I'd like to point out to the court.
You have 2 minutes.
And
in the
then,
original 50.
Can I have if, a question?
We'll make sure. We'll give you more time. Don't
worry. If she's not qualified to make that specific determination, that is only about contracting the disease. Dr. Waxman absolutely is, and that is in the record. But in terms of her etiology determination, you know, there's so much in this case about she didn't exclude all these possible causes, and that is just absolutely incorrect. I want to point out to the court that there are a lot of things that were excluded. It's not really fleshed out properly in the briefing, I don't think, because this is based not just on a knowledge that malaria can cause optic neuritis. It's based on looking at actual labs and data, and she is a doctor who is qualified to do that and in regard to this specific condition. She looked at labs. She did an MRI of the brain. She did a lumbar puncture. A lot of testing was done. And things that were ruled out were things like a brain tumor and meningitis. Those were things that she thought were plausible causes. As she testified, you know, it's not every day somebody starts going blind in both eyes. That makes you think brain tumor. She ruled out a brain tumor, meningitis, Bartonella, syphilis, bacterial infections, Lyme disease, Babesia, HLA-B27, which is a genetic condition, toxoplasmosis, which is a parasite that causes optic neuritis, and other infections. She ruled out a lot of things that she thought were plausible causes. She just didn't rule out everything in the universe, and she is absolutely qualified to rule in malaria based on the ELISA antigen test, as well as the fact that treatment of that disease, when he returned to the United States, resolved his symptoms.
Right. One quick,
I was going to say, you're out of time, but I'll let you answer Justice Brooks' question.
You know, you're going to get a false graph question. How is this foreseeable to the party? Foreseeability.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence of foreseeability is in the contract. I mean,
going from foreseeability of an illness to foreseeability an illness is going to cause a blindness. You've got a couple of steps you have to get through to get the foreseeability. How would somebody know?
Your Honor, I don't know that the foreseeability analysis requires you to per se know that malaria, while it could cause lots of problems and be harmful, could specifically cause optic neuritis. But absolutely, they knew that they were sending him to a malaria endemic country to the point that they put in their contract that they were willing to undertake providing medications, which they clearly knew were necessary to protect him from a very serious disease.
Thank you.
Right, thank you. We'll reserve your other 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Proceed.
And if it may please the court, I'm Gregory Hudson. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Guinea Roth Construction. And just as a prefatory comment to what's going on, a couple of notes. First of all, this case arises out of a no-evidence summary judgment, and the position is that the affidavits submitted provide no legally sufficient evidence of two issues. First is that Jerry Garcia contracted malaria, and second, that Jerry Garcia's malaria caused Jerry Garcia's optic neuritis. And those are two very distinct questions, and neither of the experts is going to be able to carry the ball past both of those two questions. The standard of review, of course, is an abuse of discretion, and it's informed by all the testimony that the trial judge
heard.
Well,
actually, what we have in front of us is two different types of hurdles that must be overcome as we review that. First, I think that the first thing we have to review is the trial court's order on defendant's objections to plaintiff's summary judgment, specifically as they pertain to Dr. Wounds and Dr. Waxman's affidavits, and what the standard of review is of that. Because if we find those affidavits, hypothetically, find the objections were improperly granted, then don't you automatically lose on your no evidence of motion for summary judgment?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And you're right that there is a two-step process which is going to be engaged in here. First is you're going to take a look at the objections, decide which ones should or should not be sustained on the abuse of discretion standard. Once you've done that, you basically take a Sharpie out to the affidavit, and anything that shouldn't be in there, you scratch through it, and then this, whatever is left, is what you look at to determine is what is left legally sufficient evidence to show, A, that Jerry Garcia contracted malaria, and B, that Jerry Garcia's malaria caused Jerry Garcia's optic neuritis.
But aren't so many of your attacks onto Dr. Waxman and Dr. Wounds, as it pertains both to, as I agree, did he contract malaria and was the right testing provided the gold standard test that you discussed in the brief? And then, of course, the bigger question, I think, is whether it caused the optic nerve damage and whether all the other illnesses were excluded in these type of cases. So the question then becomes, aren't those more a factual dispute then that isn't part of a no evidence motion for summary judgment and an issue that has to go before a jury as to the credibility of these experts on their qualifications?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Okay. In this case, what the testimony showed from Dr. Woon was that she had not done any of this work, that she had not actually connected the dots, that she had not gone through a proper rule out of all the potential alternative causes. And remember,
well, one of the issues is that ELS test that was conducted.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that ELS test seems to be kind of a dispute. Some say it's in the normal range. Some say it may be possibly that he has malaria. And some say that it seems that it doesn't seem that he has malaria. Isn't that a fact issue that needs to be decided as to that? Yeah, I think it is an ELS test, right? Is that what it's called?
ELISA. Yeah. And it's an antigen test, and particularly it's only a screening test. It doesn't determine anything one way or the other. As Your Honor noted earlier, a positive test, which this one was not, would be grounds to go and then do a blood test, which is the gold standard, to determine what's there, and that test was never performed. A little bit of a side issue. But the trial court's function as a gatekeeper is to look at the underlying data. Is this data sufficient to allow the expert to base an opinion on? And that's exactly what the trial judge did here. And the trial judge found otherwise.
But a gatekeeper should have been done in a Daubert Robinson motion. And so there was never a full hearing. You presented it, which I know can be done in a no evidence for a summary judgment. Procedurally, that's correct. But we run into some of these issues, and in a gatekeeper, that there wasn't a full hearing in front of this trial judge as to fully discuss the underlyings. And all we have now is affidavits. And so doesn't that pigeonhole in you as trying to make a Daubert Robinson challenge in a summary judgment?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, remember the context. There was a hearing in the front of the trial judge outside the presence of the jury, at which time the parties were able to essentially conduct a Daubert Robinson hearing. And sure. We were able to take this up on voir dire. And the issue of what does this test mean and how did Dr. Woon interpret it, and of course the evidence was she didn't know how to interpret it. That's why she sent Mr. Garcia on to talk to someone else. So that's all been done. And second, although as a defendant, often in the trial court, I wish that we had full Daubert hearings. There's nothing in the rules that requires that. The trial judge can take this up on submission, on affidavits. And of course, in this case, that's what the trial judge did, informed by the rather lengthy testimony in front of the trial court. So the trial judge had done all of that work.
You may proceed.
Okay. Let's start with Dr. Woon, who in front of the trial court admitted several things, and that testimony is in the packet I gave you. First, that she's not an expert in the diagnosis of malaria, that in her 15-year career she's encountered a malaria case all of once, and that she was not able to diagnose malaria in Mr. Garcia, which is a huge problem because in her affidavit now she goes through lengthy qualifications to say, oh, no, I know all of these things by my expertise and training. I'm fully able to make these diagnoses, except that she didn't and she couldn't hear.
Okay, but there you go. You have an affidavit that says she has all this expertise. You have her trial testimony that says she doesn't. So we are now based with having just for the sake of argument this morning, that they say the exact opposite. One, she says she's qualified, he got malaria. The other one, she says, I'm not qualified, and I can't tell you whether he even got malaria. Doesn't that in itself, because we now have contradicting affidavit as to her testimony, create an issue that overcomes the summary judgment?
We do not.
I mean, the trial judge doesn't get to decide who he believes and who he doesn't believe in a de novo review of a summary judgment.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The doctrine, and I think this is sort of a poorly named doctrine, but it's the sham affidavit doctrine. A party can't create a fact issue by contradicting their prior sworn testimony. If they could, we'd never have a summary judgment. We'd never have a Daubert.
Okay, go ahead.
And for that reason, and this gets into another issue that Your Honors were asking about earlier, which is the creation of new opinions. Because now what Dr. Woon has done is admitted at trial that she's not able to do this work, did not do this work, did not understand what the test means. And so now she's then turned around and said, no, now post-trial, after I've been limited, I've gone out and done this vast array of additional work and gotten all of this new evidence. Essentially, she's trying to create herself into an expert.
And why can't she do that? Why can't she, at this point, when there's been no limitation, go out and do the research let's say she went out and got the gold standard test and got the blood work and it showed, I don't know if it's impossible now because it's been so long, but let's just say for the sake of argument this does. What limits her or them getting another expert or anything else in order to fill the holes and to overcome the summary judgment, whether they do it with the same expert or a different expert or a different test?
Let's break that up into two different things and first talk about Dr. Woon and then talk about the ability to go out and get still further experts.
Okay.
For Dr. Woon, remember the Supreme Court's admonition all the way back in the original Daubert Robinson cases. Opinions which are developed solely for the purpose of litigation are inherently untrustworthy. That's what's happened here.
Dr. Woon is a treating physician, not an expert, So, I mean, you recognize there's a different rule for testifying experts over treating physicians. Okay, so just proceed. Go ahead.
But it's the same fundamental problem. Dr. Woon has been told that she did not have the expertise, that she did not do the work, and she's now gone back to try to self-justify the opinions that were originally held to be untrustworthy and unreliable. That is precisely the definition of an investigation infected by bias. She's not doing this now for the purpose of treating Jerry Garcia. She's already done that. She's not doing it because of she's trying to explore the truth. She's doing it to defend Dr. Woon.
Okay.
That's not proper. As far as could the plaintiff have gone out and gotten all brand new opinions? Not under this context. They would have had to have sought leave to do this and shown good cause for it, which they did not. And they had multiple opportunities to do that, because recall that once we made certain objections to their affidavits, the plaintiffs submitted new affidavits from these folks. They had over a year to get, if they so thought they could or needed to, different testimony. They did not. If the trial judge had allowed it, after seeking good cause to amend the discovery responses, that would be up to the trial judge. But that's not the procedural posture that we have here. So the problem you have with Dr. Woon is that she's trying to now self-create evidence that she didn't have originally, and she doesn't even do an effective job of that. To Your Honor's point earlier, not only is Dr. Woon unable to testify that Jerry Garcia contracted malaria, she can't make the jump to, if he did have malaria, that his malaria caused his optic neuritis. Why is that? Remember the trial testimony which informed the judge's opinions. First thing Dr. Woon testified to is it is equally likely that Jerry Garcia had a viral infection which caused the optic neuritis. And in front of the trial judge, she said that that was just as likely as if he had had malaria. Even now, you know, 18 months later and two affidavits later, she does not try to address that analytical gap in her reasoning. Neither does Dr. Waxman, for that matter. But Dr. Waxman never treated Jerry Garcia at all, never met him, never diagnosed him, never took a history or anything else. So we can stop right there. Neither one of the experts can get the plaintiffs across the final hurdle, which is Jerry Garcia's malaria, assuming he had it, caused Jerry Garcia's optic neuritis. Let's talk a little bit more about Dr. Woon, because Dr. Woon very much wants to say that Jerry Garcia had malaria, even though her trial testimony demonstrated that there were a number of other potential causes of his symptoms which she did not consider and did not rule out. That's some of the new opinions that we objected to earlier based on new articles that she was going out and looking for and all the rest of it. That's not proper, absent leave to amend the discovery, and we've talked about that. At trial, Dr. Woon testified that she relied principally on yet another doctor, Dr. Price, who she alleges told her verbally that he thought Jerry Garcia had malaria. But there's a couple of problems with that, and this goes to sort of the fundamental basis of their opinions. A, Dr. Price was working on a different chronology of symptoms than was Dr. Woon. Why is that a problem? Because the symptoms don't match up, if Dr. Price says, I think he has malaria, he's working on a different data set. And she can't take that different data set and put it over here when she thinks that data is wrong, because she's relying on a completely different chronology of symptomology. That's the Supreme Court's opinion in Garda. You can't play mix and match with opinions to try to take two unreliable and unverified experts and sort of cram them all together and make one adequate expert. Doesn't work like that. Also, of course, Dr. Price, as the trial court noted, never diagnosed Mr. Garcia as having malaria. I think that's fairly important, because the written testimony from Dr. Price that was given to the trial court says explicitly, I'm not making that diagnosis, although Dr. Woon then got on the stand and said, no, he verbally told me something different. Trial court said, King's X, you can't do that. If you want to get Dr. Price up here, you can get Dr. Price up here, but he ain't here. And of course, the final problem with all that is Dr. Woon very much wants to rely on this ELISA test, which is nothing more than a screening test, when Dr. Price told her a 0.24 is considered a negative test result. So you can't play mix and match between the two to try to get to that final opinion. It doesn't work that way. And that was the basis of the objections. That was the testimony that the trial court heard. And for that reason, there is clearly no abuse of discretion by the trial court in sustaining the objections to inadequate foundation, inadequate and unreliable data, and analytical gaps for Dr. Woon to try to get to that point.
Does it matter that the order just says competency to opine on the underlying causal factor, i.e. malaria? Because you've now said a whole different objections that this trial court relied on, but the order says to Dr. Woon's competency to opine. So it seems like you say there's no underlying foundation, there's no data for them to base it, but the objection is on the competency, which is really a qualification. So isn't there a distinguishing that the trial court didn't decide it on a causation issue, but on a competency hearing, at least from the order that I'm staring at?
I think that would be the case for the objection as to her competency only, but the other points relate to, does her affidavit even get her over the finish line? And we don't think that, of course,
what
that
other
does.
Points are we talking about? I'm confused.
The failure to rule out other causes, whether or not there's an analytical gap in her testimony. In other words, once you get past the objections issue, you still have to evaluate the affidavit at face value and say, does this affidavit present legally sufficient evidence?
So you're saying that even if we find the affidavit to be competency, in looking at it from a Daubert standard point of view, which is what we would have to look at the affidavit and decide that based on the affidavit provided in the medical records, there's no foundation or proper underlying data to support the opinions that they set out.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, that's the two-step process. Is let's establish the objections so we know what the proper evidence for the court to look at is, and then we have to make the separate determination, is that evidence legally sufficient?
What if we decide that the affidavits were, as you call it, Dr. Woon or Dr. Waxman tried to recreate themselves and make them their experts, sufficient? Does that overcome the summary judgment standard?
If you decided that they were sufficient, in what regard, Your Honor?
And that there was enough foundation or data or any at least in overcoming the Daubert challenges of foundation.
If your honors decide that, having taken your Sharpie and edited out whatever needs to be edited out, that you look at what's remaining and you determine that that remaining evidence is legally sufficient, then yes, you overturn the summary judgment.
I just want to make sure we're procedurally all correct. I'll have to sharpen my Sharpie.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You still have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much. I'd like to turn to Dr. Waxman, and I'm going to move in a reverse order for Dr. Waxman to a degree. Dr. Waxman, of course, never met or treated Jerry Garcia. Dr. Waxman's not an ophthalmologist. Dr. Waxman is not in a position to talk about whether or not Jerry Garcia's assumed malaria caused Jerry Garcia's optic neuritis. So that second opinion that they have to get to, Dr. Waxman is not here to talk about that and would not be competent to talk about that. Dr. Waxman's testimony, and I want to focus on the analytical gap issue because he spends the better part of a page in his affidavit going through a number of potential causes of Jerry Garcia's symptoms. But what he does is what we call the classic ipsy-dixit, because I said so. In other words, he lists a potential cause, and I'll take one of them, dengue fever, and he says, the symptoms are not consistent with this. Okay. Does he identify the symptoms anywhere? No. Does he say the medical text established that this is the constellation of symptoms? No. Does he establish that because you did have this test or that test, dengue fever is or is not ruled in or out? No. He just says, I find that the symptoms are not consistent. That's not enough. Even if he is a specialist in subtropical diseases, you can't just say, because I'm an expert in these, therefore I rule this out, without going through the connective tissue, and he doesn't try to do it. Take another one, chikungunya. He says, I find that this is not, that because there was insufficient physical problems, that this is not an acceptable cause. Really? Where's your medical textbook to that? Where's your list of symptoms that says, if this is not present, you don't have it? And in fact, there was some trial testimony on this with Dr. Woon that the one symptom he identifies with this condition as being a rare and present only in extreme cases. And this was a problem that the trial judge really had with a lot of these alternate causes. Nowhere was anybody able to say, because this symptom is or is not present, that is a rule out. And that's important, because otherwise, absent that kind of testimony and that kind of support in the medical literature is provided to the court, you've not connected the dots. And so Dr. Waxman's testimony on all of the rule outs is insufficient. So when you take your Sharpie and you go through that, all of those are going to go away, which leaves you with a massive analytical gap. It's simply, he says, I'm an expert, therefore I've found these things. For several of them, he says, I don't see evidence of a disease process, or there was testing done. Really? What was that? What tests were run? Why were they important? What did they show? Why would those tests have made a difference to anything? Did anybody at Victoria Hospital test for dengue fever? Does anybody at Victoria Hospital even know what dengue fever is? You can't do it like that. You have to say the medical literature establishes that this test disqualifies this condition. Here's the test. And, Your Honors, I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions, I'll sit back down.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
May I please support?
You may.
I'd like to pick up where counsel left off with Dr. Waxman. One thing that I didn't get a chance to mention in the opening argument in regard to these other purported causes, and we're talking about dengue fever and all of these things, is that the experts were not required to rule them out. Although they did, and
well,
although...
Isn't that what the Supreme Court has now told us on these toxic tort claims, that you have to rule out every other possibility in order to connect your causal relationship? And I can't remember which case it was that said that.
No, Your Honor. I think what the Supreme Court has said is that you have to rule out every other plausible cause, not every other possible cause in the universe.
Plausible versus possible.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And plausible in the case law, generally meaning there's some evidence to support it. I know I cited a Basante case, which I don't think was toxic tort. It was a 2018 Texas Supreme Court case, and the briefing that goes through the difference between a plausible cause and a possible cause. You are not required to rule out every cause that the defendant concocts out of thin air. In fact, this court's opinion, I'd like to point this court to its prior opinion in White v. Scaff, which is a 2012 case out of this court. It's cited in the briefing, but it's not extensively discussed, and I wish I would have discussed it more because
it's a great opinion from this court.
because it's a great opinion from this court that applies directly to this case. In this case, this was also a summary judgment that was predicated on lack of expert causation testimony, where the trial court essentially threw out the expert opinions on Daubert Robinson challenges and granted summary judgment. This case was also a differential diagnosis case. Both this court and the Texas Supreme Court have acknowledged that differential diagnosis, when done properly, is a reliable method, and it was absolutely done properly in this case. It's also demonstrated in this White case. In this case, you had a young lady who was in stage 4 renal failure. She started having some problems with her leg, and so she went to her treating physician. Her physician then gave her some medications, and long story short, she died of a drug overdose a few days later. So she died of a drug toxicity, basically. The experts in this case rendered opinions that because of her stage 4 renal failure, she was not able to adequately process the medications that she was given, and so the improper dosage of the medications caused her death. Now, in this case, the court recognized that the plaintiff's experts could not rule out every possible cause. Some of those were suicide and improper taking of the medication. And this court said those weren't ruled out. They are possible causes, but they're not probable causes, because based on the record before the court, they were not likely. And this court actually spoke to the standard, and talking about, you know, it doesn't have to be conclusive. The plaintiff is required to prove only that is more likely than not that the injury was caused by the negligence. The law does not require and should not require proof of an absolute certainty of causation. That is what standard the defendant would hold the plaintiff to in this case. At the end of the day, that is their main complaint, that we cannot absolutely, conclusively, without a doubt, show that he did have malaria. The experts are qualified, and they have shown that it was probable, and it is the only probable cause that has not been eliminated based on the ELISA antigen test, which I'll speak on if I have a chance. But I also want to point this court again to some language in this opinion. The court said the experts need not disprove or discredit every possible cause other than the one they espouse. There must be some evidence. Dr. Woon testified at trial, no, I didn't rule these out initially because the symptomology didn't match. I mean, you know, you're talking about yellow fever. He was vaccinated for that. A flu shot. He's never had one. They talked about the West Nile virus. He didn't have the symptoms associated with that, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, yellow spots in the retina. So,
counsel, how do you distinguish, though, with his comments or opposing counsel's comments that they didn't go through the symptoms and rule out the symptoms on the record or show tests that ruled out those symptoms are the ones that were plausible?
Counsel is absolutely incorrect. They went through the symptoms of every disease and explained that he did not have those symptoms. And they actually ruled out causes that they were not required to rule out. This differential diagnosis is very sound. And that ELISA antigen test, I'll just end on this note. Well, two things. One, their expert witness admitted in his deposition, I think it's page 64, he admitted these causes were all speculative. He didn't have any evidence of them. And every single expert in this case, including their expert, acknowledged that that 0.24 on the ELISA antigen test could show or was evidence indicative that could be past malaria infection. And that's one of the many reasons it's the only disease process that could not be eliminated.
Thank you very much. The case will be under submission.